morning. Good to see you all today. Good to see you all. If you didn't get a handout on your way in, raise your hand. We want to make sure everybody did as we're going to get started Sunday school. If you didn't get one on the way in, I see no hands. Good job, guys. You all do a great job out there in the lobby. All right, we're going to get right into our lesson today. I have way more notes than I have time, but I cannot get behind. And so today is going to be a little bit of a summary walking through some of these things. So I hope it will be a help and a blessing to you. It is, by nature of this series on evil and suffering and problems and pain, none of the subjects are fun. And so by nature of that, we kind of have to wade through them. Here's the encouraging thing. I'm dealing with basically the hardest issues that people deal with throughout the Bible. And so by the time we get to the end of the series, we've dealt with most of the tough things that we deal with in life or with our interpretation of Scripture. So it's all downhill from here. So that's good. And so I want to encourage you with that. We're going to get right into our lesson because I do not have time to do a lot of preliminaries. We've been talking about the evils in this world and the sufferings in this world and how God can be good. And we talked about that for a few weeks. And then we talked about specific evils that God seems to allow. And then we have to ask why that might be the case, specifically in the Bible itself. Now, we get some freedom with those topics because that means we're allowed to look into the Bible itself as an answer to the question. Last week, we dealt with the issue of slavery in the Bible. I'm not going to rehash any of that because I'm not going to do a good job at rehashing, and we did it last week. So you can go back and listen to this one. This week, we're going to deal with the issue of war in the Bible. I want to read one introductory passage to kind of set the stage for what this passage is about, what this issue is about, and we'll get right into it. So turn your Bibles really quickly to Deuteronomy chapter 20. Deuteronomy chapter 20. One of the biggest issues is the fact that there is a lot of war, specifically in the Old Testament. Like, it's all over the place. In fact, the word for war occurs over 300 times in the Old Testament. And if you've ever read through the Old Testament, if you've ever read the stories, you will find that you have interacted with and you have happened upon a lot of war and a lot of pain and a lot of death in just the stories. And it seems that the Bible just takes for granted that this is just a fact of life. And so how can that be so? Deuteronomy chapter 20, I want to read one passage. Deuteronomy is, of course, the last book of the first five books of the Bible, the Pentateuch, which is preparing them for entering into the promised land in the book of Joshua. And with that in mind, a lot of the things that he deals with in Deuteronomy have to do with how to walk into this promised land. Now, to preface it, when most people talk about how God couldn't be good because there's so much war in the Bible, most of the things they're talking about or thinking about has to do specifically with how the nation of Israel took over the land, the promised land, from these Canaanite people. And so this is where he introduces some of these things. Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse number 10, it says, "When thou comest nigh unto a city to fight against it," and he's talking about other cities, other places, he says, "proclaim peace to it. It shall be, if it make thee an answer of peace and open unto thee, it shall be that all the people that's found therein shall be tributaries unto thee. Thou shalt serve thee. Let them live. Let them serve. Let them work." We talked about that last week. "And it shall make, and if it will make no peace with thee and will make war against thee, then thou shalt besiege it. And when the Lord thy God hath delivered it into thine hands, thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword. But the women and the little ones, and the cattle, and all that is in the city, even all the spoil of thine enemies, which the Lord thy God has given thee, thus shalt thou do unto all the cities which are very far off from thee," which are not of the cities of these nations, "but of the cities of these people, which the Lord thy God doth give to thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth. Thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee, that they teach you not to do after all their abominations, which they have done unto their gods. So should ye sin against the Lord your God." War is an unpleasant thing, and no one likes it. When the United Nations was first formed, they began their charter with these words: "We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice," this is during World War II, "twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind, and we have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims." The scourge of war they wanted to save humanity from. Ironically, after they wrote this charter, several of the nations got together and continued research on how to build the atomic bomb. War is horrible, and yet, in a strange way, seemingly inevitable, for as nations conflict with one another. One particular soldier wrote a poem while he was in World War I, watching a lot of his own men die from the gases that they would attack the people with. And I won't say it because he reads it in Latin at the end, but he says that the old lie, sweet and proper it is to die for one's country, he says it goes away when you see your own men die right in front of you. He didn't mean it wasn't heroic or noble. He just said it was not sweet or proper. There is nothing good about war. We can praise the men who are willing to lay down their lives, but it is a scourge of the world that men fight with other men and kill each other. And war is all over the Bible. And that's kind of difficult considering the fact it's supposed to be a spiritual book. And so with that in mind, I want to give a lot of points this morning. I'm going to give them to you really, really quickly because I don't want to spend too long on each one of them. So number one, similar to what I did last week, I want to give you a biblical arc of peace. Biblical arc of peace. I want to trail this theme from Genesis to Revelation very quickly. Now, I would have said of war, but we're going to deal with some of the things about war. Let me give it to you really quickly. Letter A. God intended peace. God intended peace. When you open up Genesis 1 and 2, it is a peaceful world. God established it for peace. God established it in peace. Now, this is a little bit of a historical note that I want to give you. But when Genesis was written at that time in the world, there was a lot of other creation myths that were being circulated. One of the most famous is the Enuma Elish, which is the Babylonian myth of the creation of the world by their god Marduk. That particular story was that Marduk had a war with all the other gods, and he won. And after he won, he created a world for himself out of the corpses of the dead bodies of the war, and then made people so that they could be slaves to him. That was their creation story of how the world began. And that was a very typical one for that ancient world, where it was war that started the world. Very distinct from that is the story of Genesis 1 and 2, where everything and the whole story is centered around things are good, things are good, things are good. God intended peace, and that was a very different story. That was a very different picture than the whole world had seen. That was initiated in war. Now, why would people have write creation myths that were so steeped in war? It's so sad. Because that's what most of the ancient peoples knew, was war. If there was triumph, it came out of war. So if there is creation, it must come out of death. That's the only way we were able to think. God intended peace. Letter B. But violence accompanies the fallenness of man. Violence accompanies the fallenness of man. So, God intends peace. Man falls into sin, Genesis chapter 3. What happens in Genesis chapter 4? Cain kills his brother Abel. What happens later on in Genesis chapter 4? We see the genealogy of Cain. And one of Cain's descendants, Lamech, praises himself for the amount of violence that he has. If Cain is going, if Cain is avenged, then I will be avenged seven times more than him. And praising how much violence he had committed. And when you get to Genesis chapter 6, one of the reasons that God gives for destroying the world with the flood, it says in Genesis 6, 11, the earth was corrupt before God and the earth was filled with violence. He says in verse 13, God said to Noah, the end of all flesh is come before me. The earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Violence comes from the fallenness of man. And so it is from that setting where there was everything running amok, it is out of that that God puts an in-house check on the violence. So when Noah walks out of the ark in Genesis chapter 9, And there's the rainbow, you know, the beautiful pictures, all the animals coming out, and there's flowers blooming. We know the picture, right? And in that moment, God says to him in Genesis 9:6 that if anybody shed man's blood, then by man shall his blood be shed. And so in a not ideal situation he initiates, he says, if we are to be violent, then I am sanctioning humans to be able to watch over it. But the sad part about it is they watch over it and they put a check on it, but only through violence. Bloodshed always leads to more bloodshed in order to prevent even more bloodshed than that. It's not a good thing, but it stems out of our fallenness. God instituted three major institutions: family, church, and government. The family was right there in Genesis 1 and 2. The church, or our relationship with God, which varied over the dispensations, you know, that was even there in Genesis 1 and 2 as well. We were supposed to be able to relate to God. But the government stems out of the brokenness of humanity. We're going to hurt ourselves, so someone else has to make sure we don't hurt each other too much. And that's where it comes out. Human government is instituted in Genesis 9 after the entire world is destroyed because of the tremendous amount of violence. Police officers shouldn't exist, but they do because we have violent people and criminals. It'd be nice if nobody had to tell anybody not to do things because they wouldn't do things they weren't supposed to do. But they do things they're not supposed to do, so they have to have people to tell them not to do them. Right? Yeah. Okay. So war stems from that. Of course, we see that in the book of Judges, don't we? There's no king in Israel, so everybody does what is right in his own eyes. Go back and read the horror of Judges, the last few chapters of Judges. Rape, war, bloodshed, it's ridiculous. And that's the point, actually. When we are unchecked, we run amok. And then there are many wars throughout the Bible and throughout history. Whether it's to liberate themselves, to defend themselves, to initiate aggression, or to punish others for being evil, there is war throughout the Bible. And that's why the Ecclesiastes has to say, there is a time of peace, but there's also a time of war. James even asks that question, where does war come from? Whence come war and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lusts, which war in your members? War comes out of the broken hearts of people. So violence stems from that. Letter C, however, love and peace is essential to the Old Testament life. Love and peace are essential to the Old Testament life. We're sometimes given the impression the entire Old Testament law is only concerned with violence and oppression. At least it's posed that way at times. However, when God summarizes the law for the people of Israel in Deuteronomy chapter 6, he summarizes it as love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Earlier on in the book of Leviticus 19:18, he says, you will not avenge or bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but you should love your neighbor as yourself. Matthew 22 is when Jesus uses these two verses to summarize the entire law. In fact, God wants his people to have peace. In Numbers chapter 6, he has a blessing on his people. He says, the Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. And he tells them to seek peace. He doesn't tell them to look for war. In the book of Psalms, he says, depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. Zechariah 8, he says, these are the things that ye shall do. Speak every man truth to his neighbor. Execute the judgment of truth and peace in your gate. So though war is an inevitable part of the broken societies that we have, God did not tell his people to look for a fight. He told them to seek peace. Now, part of this big arc in the Bible takes us to the New Testament. Letter D. Citizens of the kingdom of heaven are supposed to be peacemakers. One of the really interesting things when you turn to the book of Matthew is his kingdom language. For an Israelite, the kingdom was the throne, was the nation, was the army of Israel. And what Jesus does is he turns their expectations on his head, and rather than being a zealot and seeking to overthrow the Roman government with violence, that's what they kind of expected the Messiah to be, he instead tries to draw people to the real kingdom, which is not a kingdom on earth, but which is the kingdom of heaven. And he says, our disposition has to be completely contrary to what we would expect it to be. When you open up his first major sermon in the New Testament, in Matthew chapter 5, He says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom. No, you get kingdoms through war. Jesus says, no, you build the kingdom through being poor in spirit. He says, blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the peacemakers, they shall be called the children of God. Later on in that book, he tells you not to avenge evil. He even tells you, where Leviticus said to love your neighbor, he says in Matthew chapter 5, love your enemy. And he completely changes the mindset that regular humans will have in a broken society. In fact, Jesus summarizes this better than anybody else. God the warrior becomes the crucified God, the one who receives in himself the full force of the violence that we have. Of course, in Romans chapter 12, it says, as much as lies in us, let us live peaceably with all men. Avenge not yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it's written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. In James chapter 3, it says, the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. Now, at the end of the day, the war, that's the major war in the Bible as it's pictured, is a cosmic war. It's a picture of the force of light and the force of darkness between God and Satan. And we find ourselves in the middle, and we often participate in it as we fight between our own flesh and our own spirit. And to the Christian, he tells you to put on armor and get a shield and a helmet and a sword. But he tells you to put on the armor of God. And the helmet is our salvation. The sword is the word of God. The shield is faith. The breastplate is righteousness. Our shoes is the gospel. And he reframes how we often look at it. And when we even look at Revelation chapter 12, when the cosmic forces of light and darkness are fighting between the great dragon and the lamb, he says that we overcame the dragon through the word of our testimony, because we loved not our lives unto death. And so he reframes it as we get to the New Testament, that the kingdom of heaven is not built through destroying other men's lives, but through winning them. Letter E. And of course, this takes us to the end of the Bible, that the whole creation will be restored to peace. The whole creation will be restored to peace. What's really interesting is that there's a broken expectation when you turn to the end of the Bible. In Revelation chapter 19, when all of the wars and all of the suffering and all of the pain really comes to its climax, Jesus comes back to fight against the evil. And he brings us ready for battle on white horses. But we do not fight. We just arrive. And Jesus destroys the evil with the word of his mouth. Which is a very unexpected thing. What you expect from that, and what the ancient peoples would have expected from that story, is for all of us to come on white horses and all of us to reign victorious with blood on our swords. But that's not how he pictures it, because he is responsible for the judgment of evil, and we just participate in the new world that he brings. And this is foretold all the way back in the Old Testament. In Isaiah chapter 2, he says, ye shall judge among the nations and rebuke many people. He has to judge, he has to uncreate in order to recreate. And he says this, though, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nation will not lift up their sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. And that passage is almost exactly repeated verbatim in the book of Micah as well. And of course, when you turn to Revelation 21 and 22, and you see the picture of the new earth that God creates, is a place of peace. So that's the biblical arc. And once again, we have to situate our hardest questions inside the story. We cannot rip it out and talk about it as if it's the only part of the book. There was peace. We broke it. God intends peace, and he will bring it back. And we are marching toward that as well. So let me clarify one other point. Number two, the biblical lens of war. The biblical lens of war. How does the Bible view war? What is its idea about what's really happening? Well, first of all, and this is a sad point, but it really is just true. Letter A, if a nation exists, it does so through the practice of war. Meanwhile, in spite of that arc and the desire of peace that we see in the Bible, if a nation exists, it does so through war. And several of my people who I was researching mentioned this. And it's an obvious point that it's kind of missed upon us when we look back into the nation of Israel. If it exists, it exists through war. Tell me a single nation that has existed without war, whether coming into existence or maintaining its existence. It does so through war. And the fact is, in order for the nation of Israel to become a nation, it would only do so through defending its borders and proclaiming its land. Individuals can live at peace, but a state does not have the luxury to have a whole pile of citizens who decide not to defend themselves, because then the violent nation nearby will just take them over. And so that's why in the New Testament, Romans chapter 13, it says that the state is the one that bears the sword, because if it does not, there is no state. If a nation exists, it exists through war. Now, there is a difference between war and there's a difference between war crimes. When you look, turn to the book of Amos, in Amos 1 and 2, and it talks about a lot of these other nations, it talks about the things that they did being so vile. And it's a step above just war between nations. It's a step into depravity that's unnecessary. If a nation exists, it exists through war. Letter B, since that's the case, we have to remember that God is involved in the affairs of men through war. God is involved in the affairs of men through war. God is transcendent and he is sovereign over the world, but he works inside the affairs of men. And so if war is an inevitable part of a broken world and for nations to rise and fall at all, and God is involved in the affairs of men, then we should expect God to be involved in the process of the wars. And this is what we want, isn't it? When we go to war, people are praying, God help us. And we're asking him to be involved in even the horror of the brokenness that we're involved in at the moment. For example, when the nation of Israel first came out of the land of Egypt in Exodus chapter 15, they gave God full credit for that destruction, but it was for the good purpose of bringing his people out. For God to be present, this is what we're emphasizing. Actually, throughout the Old Testament, 200 times God is directly associated with the war. The title, the Lord of Sabaoth, or the Lord of Hosts, is emphasizing his ability to have victory in battle. Not only that, by the way, our fellows are coming by. If you could take your attendance slip and drop it in, we'd appreciate that. Not only that, but throughout the ancient world, what they often saw war to be was a battle between gods. They didn't believe that there was only one God and mine was real and yours was not. They believed that all the gods were real and I just served this one and you serve that one. And when they would go to battle, in their minds, they viewed it as a battle between their gods. I would encourage you to go back and read 1 Kings chapter 20 one of these times. It's a really good illustration of this. The Israelites go to battle against the Syrians and the Israelites win. And the Syrians' evaluation of the battle is their god must be a hill god because we fought in the hills. So if we fight them again and we fight in the valley, we might have the home court advantage and we're more likely to win. And so they pick a fight with them a year later in a valley hoping to win because maybe their god's going to have be out of his element. And they still win and they just don't even understand how can our god be not as strong as their god? This is the way they thought. And so for God to be involved was for him to say that he actually has power over what's going on in the world. Now, last point underneath this, which is actually very essential to where we're going to go next. Letter C. Since God is involved, even in the horrors of what we break society to be, God has the ultimate right to judge sin. Having made this last point, it's absolutely necessary to remember that God, as the creator, is the one who has the right to do the things that humanity does not. He has the right to judge sin because he's the lawgiver. He has the right to take life because he is the creator. One of the reasons why murder is so wrong for us is because we do not have the right to end somebody's life, but the creator who gives life has the right to take it away. And by the way, if we believe the Bible to be true, we believe that everybody goes somewhere when they die. So in essence, he never actually puts somebody to death. He just transports them from one location to another. But the one who has the right to do that is the creator and the giver of life. And so we want God to watch over the world, but then for some reason we're sad when it's too difficult because of the too much sin. N.T. Wright says this, somehow in a way that we're inclined to find offensive, God has to get his boots muddy and it seems to get his hands bloody to put the world back to rights. And if we declare, as many have done, that we would rather it not so, we face the counter question as to which bit of dry, clean ground we're standing on, that we should look down from that height and pronounce the matter with such certainty. What gives us the position to say how God ought to and ought not to have entered into the affairs of men? Now, earlier on in the series, I made this very important point when we talked about God's judgment over sin as being part of the evils that happen. What often arises in this conversation is, why is there so much evil? Why does God not do something about it, right? And the thing is, throughout the Bible, what we see is that God does do something about it. And then we complain that he did too much. We cannot have it both ways. We cannot say God is sitting back and watching evil triumph, and then when he does not allow evil to triumph, then we're like, oh, no, that was too much. As if we know how it all works out. If anyone has the right to judge, it is the creator of the universe. And the Bible sees no contradiction between God's goodness and his destruction of evil. In fact, God would not be good if he did not respond to evil. That takes us to number three. Those first two points were to put some things into perspective. This third point is to clarify some misconceptions. Number three, clarity on biblical war. The first three points kind of go together in a little bit of a triad, so I'll mention them together. Letter A, the Canaanites, the group of people that the Israelites took the land from, which is usually where this conversation comes up, were not innocent. And this is what motivated God's response. The Canaanites were not innocent. This is the picture that's given. God just allows them to go in and kill all these innocent people. They were not innocent people. Just as we would see it being tremendously justified for America to walk into Germany because of the unique evil of Nazi Germany, the Canaanites had a unique evil that needed to be responded to. In fact, in Genesis chapter 15, 16, when Abraham is told by God that his people will have this land, God says, but it's not going to be for another few hundred years because the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. He gave them a lengthy period of time, even after they were already bad enough. And what we see in this ancient society is a new level of depravity that is described throughout the Bible. I gave you a lot of references in Leviticus 18, chapter 20, Deuteronomy 12. He says in Leviticus 18, defile not yourselves in any of these things, for in all these nations they are defiled, which I cast out before you. He says, the land is defiled. Therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon, and the land itself vomiteth out her inhabitants. He pictures it like when you eat something that is poisonous and your body dispels it because it is destructive to itself. That's how he pictures the Canaanites. They have lived in this land and the land itself vomits them out because they are poisonous. Several of historical commentators mention about some of the things we do know about the Canaanites. One of the gods that one of the Canaanite nations worshipped was a god named Aneth. And in one of their stories they told, he conquered these people, but he relished in the gore of the battle. He took all of the heads of his victims and wore them around his neck like a necklace. And he cut off their hands and he wore them on his belt in order to display how violent he had been. And this is one of the gods that these people served. One of the particular evils that they mention, besides the sexual immorality that he talks about these people having in Leviticus 18, adultery, homosexuality, bestiality. Besides that, one of the things that constantly comes up in the Bible is that they would kill live babies and offer them to their gods. One of them was the god Molech, who was a brass bull, they would light a fire underneath the idol and with his hands held out, and they would take a baby while the idol was burning, and they would place it on the arms and watch their baby sizzle to death and override its screams with the beating of drums. And we're saying, God, why did you react so strongly? Should he not have? We complain that God allows evil to triumph, and evil was not going to triumph in Canaan. No, what's really ironic is in the book of Deuteronomy, he actually tells the Israelites, he's giving them this land, not because they're any good, but because the Canaanites are evil. He says in Deuteronomy chapter 9, I'll just say one part of it so we can move on. He says, "Speak not thou in thine heart after the Lord thy God has cast thee out from before thee, saying, for my righteousness the Lord hath brought me in to possess this land. But for the wickedness of these nations, the Lord doth drive them out from before thee." You just happen to be the ones I'm giving it to as a result. But they're the ones I am driving out. The Canaanites were not innocent. And several times when they did fight with Israel, they did so very kind of against the code, one of them being Amalek. When they were walking through the wilderness, the Amalekites waited till they went by. You always put your soldiers in the front of your group. And rather than doing it honorably and fighting the front, they waited till they went by and they attacked the women and the children and the elderly from behind, just so that they could get as much carnage from innocent people as possible. These are the kinds of people that lived here. That takes me to point number next, letter B. The war against the Canaanites was not ethnically motivated. It was not ethnically motivated. Why did God command genocide? Genocide is when somebody decides to kill an entire race of people. That would be the Holocaust. That would be the Armenian genocide, where because of the color of your skin, then I want to get rid of you. And that's a really easy narrative to portray, especially in the racially charged situation that we are now in our country with it constantly being up. It's just not accurate. The Bible does not describe the whole thing about the war with the Canaanites as being about the color of their skin. It had nothing to do with what race they were, but about the wickedness that they perpetrated. And the Old Testament purposely shows us that it is not about where they are from, but it is about what they choose. So, the book that actually narrates the entrance into the promised land is the book of Joshua. And before they go to their first war, there's three very important stories to this point. Story number one, in Joshua chapter 5, when he goes up to the first battle of Jericho, he is looking into the city and trying to figure out what he's going to do next. And I don't think he got the actual instructions from God at that point. But he's looking over the city, that's the point. And he goes up and he's met by a man with a sword drawn. And he asks him the obvious question. And this is important. Are you for us or for our enemies? And the man replies, neither. But as captain of the host of the Lord am I come. He takes off his shoes and he bows before him, and the story is done. So before he enters his first battle, he finds out the angel who is captaining God's host, which he needs to win these battles, tells him, I'm not on your side. And I'm not on their side. And I'm not against them. Or you. I represent the Lord. Here's the point of the whole book. I will be for you only if you are for me. Okay, so Joshua chapter 6 shows up. They go to Jericho. The whole city is destroyed as they give them ample opportunity to surrender, which they don't. And they destroy the whole city except for one family, Rahab. Why? Because she had faith in the God of Israel, and she is spared. She is integrated into their society. She finds herself into the bloodline of David and of Jesus himself because she chose to be. Third story, the very next chapter over in Joshua chapter 7, Achan took of the accursed thing. His family, he and all of his family, were destroyed. Why? Because they chose not to follow God. So God says, are you for us or for our enemy? He says, neither. I want you to be for me. One of the Canaanite families was spared, and one of the Israelite families was not. Why? because of their choice to follow God or not. And this is so important to the rest of the entire book. What God is doing is judging evil and blessing disciples. And anyone can be either one. And he uses that as the preface to the rest of the wars in the book. So it was not ethnically motivated. And of course, we can bring up innumerable other examples. What about Ruth, the Moabite, who's also in the line of David, in the line of Jesus? Psalm chapter 87 talks about how it can be that Egypt and Babylon and Philistia and Tyre can acknowledge God in Zion and follow him. The minor prophets continually talk about the restoration of God's people, and all the nations can come in and worship the Lord. In Isaiah chapter 19, he talks about Egypt and Assyria doing the same thing. Jesus, of course, he ministers to anybody, especially there's several stories specifically about ministering to Gentiles. And that one woman he ministers to in the New Testament is called a Canaanite woman. That's besides the fact that most of the book of Acts is about the gospel being spread to the Gentiles. And of course, in Revelation 5 and 7, you have all people from every nation and every tribe and every tongue and every language standing before the throne of God. The war against the Canaanites was not about their ethnicity. And that takes me to my third triad on that point, letter C. The Israelites suffered the same fate. The Israelites suffered the same fate. Drive out the Canaanites. The Israelites were driven out. Why? Because they sinned. And they did the same things. If God was for Israel and against the other people, then why would God allow the Israelites to suffer the same fate? Because the same decisions were being made. I mean, read the book of Jeremiah. Almost the entire book is about the sin of Israel, and then there is an appendix on the end about the sin of everybody else. Because they were the ones struggling and that God was concerned with. And so for us to say that God was somehow having favoritism is to ignore like the whole story of the Old Testament, which is that the Israelites didn't do much better, and they had several hundred years to try it out, and they ended up being judged the same way. Letter D. I'm moving along here, but I'm running out of time too, so I'm going as fast as I can. Letter D. 2 points. The Canaanites were to be devoted to the Lord and driven out. Devoted to the Lord and driven out. This is just to clarify some terminology that the Bible uses. When the Bible talks about destroying them in Deuteronomy 7, Deuteronomy 20, it actually comes from the Hebrew word harun, which means to devote to destruction. Simply this, when he says that, he's turning it on his head where it feels like Israel's destroying them. The terminology is saying, you give them to me so that I judge their sin. And this is the way it pictures it. But not only that, a constant terminology throughout the Old Testament is the idea of driving them out and dispossessing them. So Numbers chapter 21, it says, the Moses sent to spy out the place and took the villages thereof and drove out the Amorites. And I gave you a bunch of other passages as well, that they would possess the land in their stead. Exodus 23 says it this way, I will send my fear before thee and will destroy all the people to whom thou shalt come, and I will make all thine enemies turn their backs unto thee. I will send hornets before thee, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, the Hittite from before thee. I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate, and the beasts of the field multiply against thee. By little and little I will drive them out from before thee until thou be increased and inherit the land. He says, I will push them out. So even that terminology, which shows up over and over again, Numbers 21, Deuteronomy 9, 11, 18, 19, is about them being dispossessed. Both those go together with how Israel is described. When Israel is told to have been judged by the exile, they were called being destroyed, but they also were exiled. The people left. Many people died, and many people left. And this is the picture that God gives to the Canaanites as well. So we have to see it in that light. Letter E, don't fire me for being a heretic. I want you to listen for 2 seconds, okay? The language of biblical war is exaggerated. You're fired, Nathan. I know. Listen, it is exaggerated. A constant custom in the ancient world was to speak in hyperbolic terms. We destroyed everything that breathed. Nothing was left behind. There's a lot of ancient examples of this from Egypt, Moab, Assyria, where this is a common way to talk about how awesome we are and how horrible our enemies are. But we know that it's exact. So we would expect that in the Bible. But we know it's exaggerated because of some things that we have to see and reckon with. Joshua chapter 10, it says this: Joshua smote all the countries of the hills and of the south and of the vale and of the springs and all their kings. He left, watch, none remaining, but utterly destroyed all that breathed as the Lord God of Israel commanded. Now from that picture, if it's literally taken and not the convention like when we win a basketball game and we annihilated them, which we didn't annihilate them, we just beat them well, right? If that's literal, then there are no more Canaanites left in the land, right? But there are, because the very next chapter over, he says, Joshua was old and stricken in years, and there remaineth yet very much land to be possessed. And as you open to the book of Judges, he talks about how the people of Benjamin, they didn't drive out the Jebusites, the people of Manasseh, they lived there until this day, the Canaanites, they allowed them to stay. Even in the classic story of the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15, he tells them to destroy every single person that's an Amalekite. Now, he might have meant that for that city, but as you turn just a few pages down the way in that book, there's Amalekites that fight David. You say, well, Saul didn't kill everybody. Well, Saul only spared King Agag, and Samuel hacked him to pieces at the end of the story. So there are no Amalekites left, except for the fact that there are a few chapters later. So apparently, the terminology of that day wasn't actually to be literally taken, because we have both of those intentions. And that was a common convention of the day. So when we look at that, we have to put it into that perspective, which takes me to the whole idea of men, women, and children. That would have been the part of the terminology you would use when you would attack a city and whoever happens to be in there. And one other side point, it's been fairly confirmed that a lot of the cities that Joshua attacked during the attack of the Promised Land were military forts. There's actually no archaeological evidence of a civilian population in Jericho or in Ai. And judging by how the Old Testament era was structured and from some secular sources we have as well, a common thing for a walled city would have been a military fort. And a lot of the people would be living in the plains. And we know a lot of them stayed there because a lot of them are there when you turn to the next book of the Bible. And so they attacked the combatants more than likely, and that's the picture we see here. Letter F. Many wars in the Bible were defensive. Many wars in the Bible were defensive. Now, that doesn't mean all of them were, but many of them were. After Jericho and Ai, if you actually read the story, there's a whole southern campaign through all the cities in southern Israel in Judges chapter 10. But it was initiated because the five kings gathered together and attacked their only ally, the Gibeonites. In Judges chapter 11, they do the northern campaign of all the major cities in the north. And that one was initiated by the enemies. They attacked Israel first. Besides the fact that as you look through the rest of the Old Testament, most of those were defensive as well. They were actually told not to take land outside of their borders. He specifically says in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 2, they were not supposed to take the land of Moab or Ammon or Edom because that was not in the land that God gave to them. So many of the wars were defensive. Letter G. The conquest of the Canaanites was unique. It was a unique time in Israel's history. Some people in later years have taken these stories and said, oh, well, that means we're supposed to judge all people that are not followers of the Lord. Muslims did this. Certain Christians have done that, like with the Crusades, or certain people that follow Calvin and Augustine. So the Jews, the Zealots, they had that same picture. But a lot of Jewish interpreters, even of their day, didn't see that as a sanction of war. One commentator once said this: I doubt if anybody who is a peace-loving person read the Old Testament and said, oh, I guess I'm supposed to fight somebody. That's not really the way that it's been interpreted. No, what God was wanting for these people was for them to give them the Promised Land away from the wicked people and to flourish in that land well, and they did not. And this was a unique time in Israel. Really, the entire conquest of Canaan took place in one generation. Letter H, there were limits on war. There were limits on war. All's fair in love and war, right? Well, no, not even in the Bible. There's actually a particularly sticky passage in Deuteronomy chapter 21 where it says about marrying somebody in war. Now, what was very common in the ancient day was war rape was very normal because it was seen as a spoil of war and it was seen as evidence that we have conquered the men because the men's job is to protect the innocent. So since you have not protected the innocents, I'm rubbing it in your face. There's a passage in here that says something specifically about women that some people take offensively, but the passage actually is a great example of a restriction on war. So one of the things that it says in that passage is if you go to war and there is a woman that you want to marry, he says you can marry her. You are allowed to integrate her into the Israelite society if you wish. He says, but several things have to be true. She is not a concubine. She is not a slave girl. She is going to be your wife. You're choosing her to be your wife. But don't just go in and take her. You give her 30 whole days to mourn the loss of her family, and that also lets any of those emotions settle down as well. And if you choose not to marry her at the end of those 30 days, you do not sell her into slavery. She's not a piece of property. And you do not just throw her out on the street because you've dishonored her by going to war with her people. He says that at worst, you divorce her appropriately like you would with any other Israelite, which means you make sure she's taken care of and she has a financial stipend on the way out the door. Now, that sounds bad, except for the fact that that was completely unheard of in the entire ancient world. So if you want to marry somebody, you can, but you're going to do it right if you ever do. There's even a small sanction in Deuteronomy, I think it's 19, that it says, 20. Deuteronomy 20. He says, when you go in, you got to chop down some trees when you're going to war. If it's got fruit on it, don't chop down the fruit trees. Fruit trees are nice. Just chop down the tree next to it that doesn't have fruit on it. Keep the fruit trees there. That way you're not walking in, you know, the picture of the desolate wasteland of everything burned up. He says, I don't want you to do that to the land. When you walk in there, leave some foliage, okay? You're going to have to live here. So take care of the place. He even bothers to mention that in the process. There was limits on war. Now, these are just clarifying points. And all this is simply to say this. That the general picture of war given in the Bible is often mischaracterized primarily by our ignorance of what was really happening. Now, let me give you the last point. I got to be done. I'm going to give it to you really quickly. So what in the world can we learn from this? Biblical war teaches, it's your blank, practical lessons. Biblical war teaches practical lessons. What are they? Letter A. Our fallenness and brokenness brings despair and death to those around us. War is a terrible thing. It is a result of broken societies and sin in the hearts of people. And it is a reminder to us that our sin brings death. The wages of sin is death to us and to those around us. War is a terrible thing because of the terribleness of sin in the first place. Letter B. What else does it teach us? The ideal is the kingdom of God, not human institutions. Why is this such a big problem? Because the war between societies has never been a very clean or a very good thing. We have noble and heroic soldiers, but there's nothing, what was the terms he used? There is nothing proper or sweet about war. And he says, so what that should fix our eyes toward is to be members of the kingdom of heaven, which is what Jesus told the people to be. If God works in the affairs of men by fighting in the wars of men, it should be a reminder to long after the triumph of the kingdom of heaven, not by conquering over people, but by winning them. And letter C, the lessons serve as a figure that tells us we ought to deal radically with sin in our own life. Radically with sin in our own life. Now, if we spiritualize the passage, it doesn't take away from the literalness of it, and that's why I wanted to deal with all those things before. However, there's a lesson here. God is dealing radically with sin. There's a little pamphlet that John MacArthur wrote where he was talking about how we have to put to death our own sin. Colossians 3, he says to mortify our members that are on the earth, fornication and uncleanness. Romans 8 says that if we live after the flesh, we will die. If we live after the spirit, we do mortify the deeds of the body. Why? Because in Romans 8 earlier, he says to be carnally minded is death. Jesus commands us in Matthew 5 that if something offends us, our hand, our eye, to cut it off or to pluck it out because it will destroy us. Because the lusts of this world, 1 Peter 2:11, war against our soul. And John MacArthur named that little pamphlet from the story in 1 Samuel 15, Hacking Agag to Pieces. That was the name of the pamphlet. To remind us that when there's sin in our life, we deal with it radically. We put it to death. And this is a picture to us that the death and the destruction and the corruption in our own life needs to be dealt with radically. And that's what God was doing in the Old Testament. Here, there's a lot of things in there. I tried to cover a lot of it, and I gave you plenty to look at and to research. If you have any other questions, you can let me know. But what God is showing us here is that he's involved with us, but he does not look at sin very kindly. And it destroys us, and so he answers it. And so in a weird backward sense, one of these issues that's really a charge laid against God is a vindication of him, that God does deal with the evil in this world. And he deals with it inside of the world as we have it. And it's not ideal, but this is the world we have. And so we look forward to the redemption, and it keeps our eyes on the sky. We have two more lessons left that I'm looking forward to. So be here next week, and we'll talk about hell next week. And we'll talk about the resurrection the week after that. So let's pray, and we'll be dismissed.